Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Independent Center for Responsive Politics is now predicting that more than $4 billion could be spent by candidates, political parties, and outside groups this midterm elections. $4 billion. So today we're going to follow that money. Now, to start, the Democratic Party has raised more money than the Republican Party. But according to Dale Leventhal, again of the Center for Responsive Politics, when you get into the realm of outside spending, conservative-leaning groups like Karl Rove's American Crossroads effectively obliterate the left-leaning groups, although now, with a week till elections, the Democratic groups are waking up. Reporter Dan Egan follows the money for The Washington Post. He joins us from the Post Radio studio. Dan, welcome.
Glad to be here.
You write that until just a few weeks ago, Democratic allies, outside groups, were being outspent by Republican groups by 7-1. What's the ratio now?
Well, it's approaching half and half, not quite there yet, roughly 40-ish percent of the money in the last week that was spent by the outside groups went to benefit Democrats.
Well, and we wondered if you had thoughts on how this came to be. President Obama spoke out against groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and American Crossroads, Karl Rove's group, and its nonprofit subsidiaries. We've reported here on how some of these instant nonprofits are by law only supposed to devote 50% of their time on politics, but they're doing it full time. Nobody's really regulating this. And because they're nonprofit, they're able to keep their donors secret. And Obama sent a signal to his backers, I don't like this. And we've read analysis that his backers took him at his word and that many of them sat out this kind of fundraising early on because they thought that was the message. Are they deciding now that was a mistake?
Well, there's a little evidence of that. There seems to be a little strategy here, too. Part of it might be when you have less money, you save more of it until the end. The overall total since this all started will still almost certainly favor Republicans in terms of outside groups. So, that little strategy involved, there's a lot of different things involved.
Right. And we won't know until Bob Woodward or you write the book. But in the meantime, as you're reporting, the Democrats are catching up and perhaps saying that they're just doing now what Republicans have been doing. But Republicans are saying the same thing. The Democrats, for instance, had the PAC advantage in 2004 and 2008. Karl Rove was critical of that then, and over this past weekend, Bob Schieffer on CBS asked Rove about comments he made in 2004, in which he then criticized the spending by these liberal 527 groups who were outraising Republican groups back then. So here's what Rove said back in 2004, and then his response to Bob Schieffer's questions now.
I'm against all the 527 ads and activities. I don't think they're fair. I don't think it's appropriate. They're misusing the law. They all ought to stop.
So why is it, if they were that bad back then, they're so wholesome now?
I'm not suggesting that. It is what it is. And the choice is whether you fight the battle with one arm tied behind your back or not. As I say, I wish we had a different system, but we got the system we got.
Well, but Dan Egan, is there also another factor that now Republicans have the Supreme Court decision, which frees up so much corporate money? Yes, it also frees up money from the unions, but it is a different system than it was back in 2004 because of the amount of corporate money that can flow.
Yeah, it's really a volume question. Many of the things that are being sort of either blamed or attributed to the court decision you're referring to, much of it could technically have happened before, but there was always a gray area. There was an uncertainty, and this has freed up the possibilities. And there are also some specific cases where particular millionaires, oil barons, others who have maybe their own company, they don't have to worry about shareholders. They certainly can do much more now than they could. And the group that Karl Rove is affiliated with, American Crossroads, has been a prime beneficiary of that.
Well, and what about the transparency of that money? You quote Eddie Vail of the AFL-CIO, who says, look, unions have the strictest disclosures of anyone. Rove was asked about that by Schieffer, and he said, no, it's not true. So what is true? As the Democrats and unions and outside groups on the left get more involved, are they being more transparent than the Republican groups have been?
I mean, unions do have fairly rigid disclosure requirements. A lot of it goes to the Labor Department, which people basically ignore, but they do eventually disclose quite a bit. I think the cutoff point is something like all donors over $5,000 are eventually disclosed by the unions. The beef on the conservative side is they will argue, for example, the individual steelworker in Pittsburgh who pays $700 in dues or whatever it is to his local union, you know, his name doesn't appear anywhere as a donor.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing that they argue about.
Well, let's take a look at one of the new liberal-leaning groups, the new super PAC, America's Families First Action Fund. Who are they? How much are they raising? When did they come about?
They came about very recently. I think they technically filed their papers in August, but didn't really do anything until 2 to 3 weeks ago. And they are Democratic consultant types, no household names like Karl Rove, just people who've been somewhat active in Washington Democratic politics for a while. And they went from, you know, $0 to $5 million in what, a week. And they're going to spend at least $10 million by next Tuesday is what they've told me. Because they are what is called a super PAC, this is one of the things that was made possible by the Supreme Court ruling. It's essentially a different vehicle to spend political money. And you can raise as much money as you want. You can spend as much money as you want. The rub is those are disclosed. Super PACs are disclosed. And it should be said that a big part of the American Crossroads operation is disclosed because they are also a super PAC. They have another arm that is a nonprofit that, right, as you mentioned earlier, does not have to disclose. So right, it's a real mix of disclosure, non-disclosure, limited, unlimited. It's hard to keep track of, I'll tell you that.
Well, and what are the outside groups primarily doing with their money?
I think it's fair to say that the biggest conservative groups that have gotten a lot of attention, from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to American Crossroads to the American Action Network, seem to be almost exclusively devoted to television ads and some radio ads. When you hear reports from Colorado and places like that where, as far as anyone can tell, there are no other ads running on the air, that's what the impact of that is. On the other hand, unions, for example, they have a much stronger tendency to do the voter registration, canvassing, get out the vote, and that kind of thing.
Well, and we read in Politico that in total, conservative groups have spent $169 million on ads attacking Democratic House and Senate candidates. And that's compared to about $80 million from left-leaning groups. And that's figures as of this past Tuesday, a couple days ago. So you talk about Democrats creeping up. Do you think that's going to drastically change that number?
It's going to close somewhat, it seems, but I don't know that they're going to catch up if you measure the whole election cycle.
Well, and we should also point out that the equation is sort of reversed when you look at the Democratic and Republican parties, not the outside groups. The Democratic Party, right, is trouncing the Republican Party in fundraising by almost $270 million. Why is that?
Well, it's the powers of incumbency in part. It's also the matter that you just have a bunch of money left over from last time when you won. And that's what the conservative argument will be is, hey, we're just evening the playing field here a little bit.
With the money they're getting in these outside groups. But what do these outside groups say about the future of the party system?
Parties are losing power dramatically. I mean, in the money race, at least, you know, it wasn't that long ago when the parties and candidates themselves, you know, made up sometimes as much as 80% of the money that was being spent in elections. Right now, when you look at independent expenditures reported to the FEC, only a third of it comes from the two major parties. So the outside groups are now dominating that whole part of the political process. And that basically takes more control out of the hands of the parties. Now, there's also a chicken and egg question there, whether it is, you know, is that driven in part by something like the Tea Party movement, or was the Tea Party movement made possible in part by a loosened regulatory environment? It's,
right,
it's hard to say. But it should be noted that although we've been talking a lot about the decreasing power of the parties, you should not count them out entirely. Mm-hmm. They and the candidates still account for the bulk of money being spent in the election.
Well, I guess the question is, when you say that this amount of money that we're seeing being raised by the outside groups means sort of the diminishing of the parties, right now these outside groups aren't really operating completely outside of the party?
There's a game that's played in Washington, and it's a very legalistic and very formal game because FEC rules, federal election rules, forbid these groups from what's called coordinating with campaigns. And, you know, to be fair, they set up very elaborate systems in some cases to avoid appearing like there's any coordination. At the same time, winks and nods get you a long way, and I think it's pretty clear for partisans on either side what direction their party wants to go in, what messages they want to send. There's a whole industry built up around this. So while it's not direct coordination, certainly there is an affinity of interests, I guess.
Well, you mentioned the Tea Party, and we want to, you know, distinguish. There are grassroots groups. There's also organized groups like the Tea Party Express, run by Republican operative Sal Russo. Now, they gave $250,000 to Christine O'Donnell before her primary last month. In fact, in many states, we mentioned Delaware, but Alaska, Arizona, Nevada, Utah, during the Republican primary at the last second when there were Tea Party candidates trailing badly, a national Tea Party organization, one of the ones associated with Republican operatives, came in and saturated the campaigns with cash, and those candidates won. So obviously, there are some outside groups operating outside of the party.
Right, exactly. Well, and that's been probably in some ways the biggest political story of 2010 has been the dance between the Republican Party and the Tea Party movement. Yes, they're definitely operating outside the party system. It particularly was clear during the primaries. You know, things have come together now during the general election.
But just overall, though, where would you rank these organized Tea Party groups like the Tea Party Express or Dick Armey's Freedom Works on outsider spending?
They are not actually huge spenders. If you just look at the money, well, first of all, I should say FreedomWorks is tough to tell because FreedomWorks, most of its money is not reported to the FEC. They run the kind of issue ads, and they do a lot of, I think, grassroots stuff that is not within the confines of election regulation. So we don't have a way of counting it. Tea Party Express, which is probably the largest Tea Party-named group, you know, they're 25th on the list of groups. Mm-hmm. And they've basically focused on three key races that are up on Tuesday, and that's in Nevada, and that's in Delaware, and that's in Alaska.
By the way, who's number 1 through 5 on your list?
Non-party groups. Mm-hmm. U.S. Chamber of Commerce, number 1. American Crossroads, number 2. American Action Network, number 3. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, number 4. And Service Employees International Union, number 5. So you've got two unions and three conservative groups at the top of the heap.
Right. Well, you mentioned candidates. You reported that they're on track to raise the most money for a midterm election, almost $2 billion. And then you have the three candidates in particular. I mean, it's just an astonishing number. The California gubernatorial candidate, Meg Whitman, has spent $163 million fighting Jerry Brown. Rick Scott is neck and neck with Alex Sink in the Florida governor's race. Rick Scott has spent $60 million of his own money. And Linda McMahon has spent $46 million of her own money in the Connecticut Senate battle. And she's behind Richard Blumenthal there in Connecticut. Do the math, it's like $250 million.
And at this moment in time, only one of them has a good shot at winning. Money does only go so far.
But just, Dan Egan, overall, $4 billion, the new total of spent on midterms, not, presidential elections. Is there any sense that there might be some tipping point here, or is it a tipping point into more spending?
I should never wildly predict, but just based on the general, you know, where things have gone, 2008 was a $5-point-something-or-other-billion-dollar election. I think you could be looking at a $10 billion election in 2012. I don't see why not.
Dan Egan, national reporter for The Washington Post. Dan, thanks for all your research. Terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. The Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the latest craze in alcoholic beverages, those sweet, fruit-flavored drinks that look like sports drinks but contain up to 4 times the alcohol in one beer and as much caffeine as several cups of coffee. These drinks like Four Loko have been banned at some colleges because they're sending kids to the ER. Michael Rehart is an emergency doctor at Lancaster General Hospital in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Much of what he has to say is going to be disturbing, but Dr. Rehart, we want to hear it. Tell us what you've seen.
We, over the past 8 weeks or so, have seen quite an increase in alcoholic intoxication from a beverage called Four Loko. The interesting thing about it is it seems to span all spectrums of ages and socioeconomic classes, anywhere from a 15-year-old girl to, you know, a 30-year-old man. And what's universally concerning is the level of alcohol intoxication. People are coming in unconscious with vomiting, and certainly very, very dangerous.
Why is it dangerous? How do you explain to a kid why getting so drunk can be so dangerous?
you know, the way alcohol works is it's a depressant, and at high doses it can cause vomiting. And so between the depressant effect and the vomiting, you can compromise your airway. And typically when you hear somebody died from alcohol poisoning, it's because usually they vomit, they compromise their airway, and they suffocate.
They choke.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And why is this drink, you mentioned Four Loko, more serious than, you know, the other beers or mixed drinks kids might be throwing back?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One, the packaging of it, it looks like one beer. And as an emergency room doctor, we often hear, honest doctor, we only had one. But in fact, when you're drinking this one, you're getting somewhere between four and six beers, depending on how you do the calculation. The other thing is it's a very pretty can. It looks like every other energy drink out there. And the third thing is the fact that it's sweet, and I kind of look at it as a gateway alcoholic beverage, just like the wine coolers of the 80s. But with the wine coolers of the 80s, they were low alcohol. This is high alcohol. It's enticing, and it's a large volume. Then you add in the fact that you have fortified with stimulants like caffeine, and instead of getting sleepy or tired when you're drinking, the caffeine keeps you in the game longer, so you theoretically and actually drink more alcohol, get more intoxicated, and it's a recipe for disaster.
So tell us some more about some of the kids you're seeing. You mentioned a girl 15 years old. Like, how much might a small-sized girl drink?
Well, an average-sized 15-year-old girl, 15- to 16-year-old girl, you know, 100 pounds, 110 pounds, I saw in the emergency department, as well as three or four of her friends, all of them had blood alcohols greater than 100. But not only that, they had lost consciousness and were vomiting. All these girls were on one can. Their blood alcohol is legally intoxicated with one can.
In another case, we understand you saw eight guys, one unconscious. What had they drunk?
Well, we had seen them over a span of a weekend, but one particular man, he was trying to drink four cans. I guess there's an urban myth, if you drink four, you will get the effects of liquid cocaine. And so his friends described to me that he went through the first beer, the second beer, and by the third beer, or Four Loko, he had lost consciousness. And his blood alcohol was in excess of 350, which, if you look at the laboratory data, that is at the level of comatose and near death.
Well, and what's the equivalent? Let's say he'd had those four cans. What's the equivalent in beer?
Well, that would be about 16 beers. And, you know, some people could say it's up to 24 beers, depending on how you do the math. But I don't think anybody intentionally sits down, well, I guess some people do, but intentionally sit down to drink 16 beers in a short period of time.
Right. The co-founder and managing partner of Fusion Projects, which is a five-year-old Chicago company that owns Four Loko, says that the drink is being unfairly singled out. He says that we, you know, put right on the can that it has alcohol in it. He says they take steps to prevent products from getting into the hands of minors. But we know lawmakers in New York are trying to ban these drinks. Some colleges are cracking down on Four Loko and other drinks. Ramapo College in New Jersey and Central Washington University in Ellensburg, Washington have already banned them. What's your feeling about a ban, a college ban?
Well, I think that certainly public education is very, very important, and I think that our legislators and other officials have to look at some method of regulating how this drink is dispensed. The other thing that I can say that is just for the packaging alone, one family member, a mother, was in tears, and she said, "Dr. Rehart, look at this. This has been sitting in my refrigerator for weeks, and I didn't know it was an alcoholic beverage because it's a pretty flowery can."
So parents should be, you know, looking for it. But do you worry that even in us talking about it now, I mean, I can just hear a young kid listening and hear all they're hearing is, wow, all that alcohol in one drink and it tastes good.
Yes, and, you know, it costs $2.50 to $3 a can, so it's very inexpensive.
Well, there you go. I mean, another, you know, instead of warning young people against it, you know, it's that thin line. Do you worry that in talking about it, we're spreading the word about it?
Well, it's always a concern, but I think in good faith as a physician, information is very, very important. And I can debunk this urban myth that you're going to get some sort of euphoric feeling after drinking four. Several things are going to happen when you drink four or three or drink to excess on Four Loko. You're going to get drunk. You're going to get stupid. You're going to throw up, and you could potentially die.
That's Dr. Michael Rehart, emergency room physician at Lancaster General Hospital in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. By the way, Dr. Rehart, the 15-year-old who passed out on one can, choking on her vomit, the young men nearly comatose, choking on their vomit, once you saved them in the emergency room, do you think that they are going to spread the word on this?
Almost universally, anybody that has overindulged in Four Loko, in my experience with this, has said, this is the last time I'm doing it. I spoke to a school teacher who had a student come in, and the student had said to the school teacher, I drank three Four Lokos, and then he said, and I was in the emergency room on Saturday night, and I got a catheter in my penis, and I threw up all over myself. I'm never drinking Four Loko again.
Dr. Rehart, thanks.
You're very welcome.
An update now from Indonesia, where the death toll from the tsunami is more than 340 people and is expected to climb because hundreds of people may have been swept away. Meanwhile, the Mount Merapi volcano that killed more than 30 people this week erupted again today as mourners held a mass burial for the dead. The BBC's Rachel Harvey reports.
We've come as close as we can get to the volcano. And all around me, the road, the buildings, the lush vegetation, it's all covered in a layer of volcanic ash. It's got this sort of dull grey tone to it now. We've come to a school that's been turned into an emergency shelter. Many of these people spent the night here. There are mattresses on the floor and lots of food around. They're being provided plenty to eat and drink.
Setelah saya lari kurang lebih 10 menit, 1 kilo.
And she's saying that within about 10 minutes after the volcano erupted and that the ash and the volcano, as she was running away, she could feel the smoke, the ash catching in her throat and making her eyes sore. Well, as you can hear, the rain is now pouring down, but it's something of a relief because it's washing away that volcanic ash that was covering everything and clearing the air. Before now, was really beginning to catch in the back of your throat. I'd only been outside for about 15 minutes and my clothes were absolutely covered in that ash. So the rain is welcome. There's a coordination centre that we've stopped at just as dusk is falling. There are some soldiers who are sitting down. They've been involved in the rescue operation, but they're now just relaxing, smoking cigarettes, waiting to be told what they should do next. This is where the plans are made and put into operation. So I just want to find out how those plans have been going. So I'm just going to talk to Taufik Wahyudi from the Disaster Mitigation Agency.
The focus of today is to recover the bodies of victims and keep people from going into the danger area.
Have people generally followed the advice that you've been giving them?
Kalau setelah kejadian, yeah.
After the eruption, yes, but before that it was difficult because the activity of the volcano was unusual. Before, when we were put on red alert, it was easy to see the fire in the air, but this time it was quiet and then suddenly erupted, so it surprised people.
It's well after dark now, and at another emergency center, there are people queuing up to be given free food. And just to my left, sitting in an open-sided tent, there are four children sitting cross-legged on the floor, gathered around two candles, getting ready to settle down for another night away from home.
That report from the BBC's Rachel Harvey. Well, let's take a second to hear from some of you. In Jane Clayson's conversation about the language of political debates, including Republican candidate Sharon Angle's use of the phrase man up in her debate with Democrat Harry Reid, listener Michael Farrell points out you left out a key accelerant of the man up phrase, private industry. Miller Lite Beer has been using it for a long time. Well, right he is.
Man up, because if you're drinking a light beer without great Pilsner taste, you're missing the point of drinking beer.
Mike writes, this phrase and phenomenon owe as much or more to private industry as to politics. And Mark Lowry of Kansas City, Kansas adds another thought. He says, you talked all around the issue without ever calling the phrase for what it is, sexist. Can you even imagine a scenario in which during a political debate, the male candidate taunts the female by saying, it's time for you to prove that you're a real woman, or even, come on now, put your big girl panties on. The language would rightly be called out as sexist, demeaning, offensive, and patronizing. In our review of Mark Twain's recently released autobiography, we noted how it was a bestseller before its release date, November 15th. Well, Alexa Ritchie, a Barnes & Noble bookseller in Evansville, Indiana, wrote to say, "It's already available. It's on the bookshelves." So we're guessing the industry caved to the demand. Go get yours, but bring your radio flyer wagon to carry it in. And finally, we heard from former beekeeper Bill Murphy in response to our story on how climate change is making the fall last longer. Now, Bill writes, that means that instead of staying in their hives, bees are coming out and flying in October, but there's no food source. He writes, the bees are eating their internal energy reserves and as a result may run out of food in March. They will starve. Well, if you have a concern about a bee or another bee in your bonnet, go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or scroll down and leave a comment right there. We'd love to hear from you. Back in 30 seconds. Here and Now.
I have acted in a way that violates my obligations to my family and that violates my or any sense of right and wrong.
Remember former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer back in March 2008, after news broke of his involvement in a prostitution ring? He was client number 9. Now he's a host of a CNN show. Then there was Mark Sanford, governor of South Carolina. He of the hiking the Appalachian Trail euphemism for his trip to Argentina to visit his lover. According to Sanford's now ex-wife, he's still seeing his lover, and he's enjoying a 55% approval rating. Could it be possible that the political sex scandal is dead? Louise Rogue, editor at the Daily Beast, poses that question in a recent posting. She joins us from New York. And Louise, you actually say maybe not dead, but definitely what? Having a shortened cycle?
Yeah, I think clearly the sheer volume of scandals has sort of deadened our sensitivity to it. Voters are not punishing politicians at the polls anymore for perceived, you know, from sexual indiscretions or for affairs.
So there's a sort of a shortened scandal redemption cycle.
I spoke to Laura Kipnitz. She's written a book about sort of adventures and bad behavior. And she talks about how the scandal redemption cycle is much more sped up. You know, it seems like certainly that cycle has contracted somewhat. Voters at the polls no longer penalize politicians for sexual indiscretions.
Well, give us some more examples because you list them. For instance, Nevada Senator John Ensign.
You know, he seemed like a prime candidate to kind of self-destruct. Not only did he cheat on his wife, he did it with a woman who was married to one of his aides. And after that scandal became public, you know, voters did not seem to care all that much. His poll numbers, yeah, they dipped for a while, but he's back up, and there's an ongoing ethics investigation, but he has announced his plans for seeking re-election, and voters seem to, you know, not care anymore.
Well, even though the aide, the husband of the woman that Ensign was having the affair with, wrote a letter to Fox News saying, the actions of Senator Ensign have ruined our lives. Help me. I want justice and restitution. He appealed to Fox News. Nothing.
Nothing. I mean, the Nevada voters just did not seem to care. And I don't think it's exclusive to Nevada or Vegas. We see it with Nikki Haley in the gubernatorial primary this year. She trounced her opponent, despite allegations of her having, you know, marital infidelities.
Well, and of course, the person who some say made fine art of this issue, Bill Clinton. You write his rehabs have been so triumphant that someone on your site wrote that he may have set a new bar for a successful post-presidency despite, you know, the allegations against him. So it's on both sides of the aisle. But it doesn't always work. You know, what about John Edwards? And I'm just wondering, does a child in the picture change voters' willingness to be accepting?
Well, I mean, I think children certainly complicate matters. I'm not sure with Edwards if it was really the sexual indiscretions or if it was just that voters sort of tired of him. I mean, it could have been a lot of different things. I mean, going back to Clinton, for example, you know, it seemed like with the Ken Starr investigation, you know, the more that the deeper that Ken Starr sort of dug, the more popular Clinton became. I mean, even feminists were sort of saying, well, you know, we shouldn't penalize Clinton for this. He was almost sort of considered a stud.
Which makes you wonder how Gary Hart must feel. This is the 1987 presidential candidate. You wonder if he must feel a little cheated by history, because after all we know that he did was allow a young lady to sit on his lap, an unfortunately named yacht, Monkey Business. But that was it, a photo.
Right. But it was also, I mean, who can forget that photo? Like, her sitting on his lap, that was just classic with that T-shirt, the Monkey Business. It was interesting. I mean, 1987, it seems like a long time ago. And yet I was looking at old clips, and the Miami Herald wrote a story back in the day talking about sex in the political campaigns. And Gary Hart was actually quoted saying he thought that people are going to get tired of this question, that people would simply tire of all these sort of sexual stories when it comes to politicians. And it seems like he's right.
Maybe we're heading towards, you know, Denmark. You're originally from Denmark, and you say, you know, people there seem to separate personal mistakes from being a good politician. Do you think that America is, you know, it's the home of the Pilgrims and the Puritans originally. Do you think America is becoming like other countries?
Well, I think we're certainly moving in that direction. You know, when we look at our politicians, what is it we want them to be? I mean, in a certain way, we want them to be, you know, better versions of ourselves. But then when they stray, we sort of also kind of take delight in learning about their frailties and their perceived shortcomings. There's been so many stories now that I think we've lost our ability to be shocked. As I argue in the piece, it's about time we maybe retire this kind of storyline, because unless there's some kind of other impropriety, i.e. involving money or power abuse, and of course, I mean, those kinds of stories are important. Like if it's unwanted sexual advances and power abuse, you know, those are serious kind of allegations, and I think that they're important to cover. But consenting sex between adults?
That's Louise Rogue. She's an editor at The Daily Beast. Talking about how the scandal redemption cycle seems to have sped up for politicians. Louise, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, and if we may now, a quick observance on the Walkman. The Walkman, it liberated people long before the iPod. It was a miracle. This week, the Sony Corporation announced it will cease producing the Walkman personal audio cassette player in Japan. Now, they quickly later said it will be available elsewhere. But all the concern got Nate DeMeo from the Memory Palace remembering the consumer product that took the world by storm in 1979.
They were suddenly everywhere. You could try to say how it was like all of a sudden in 2005, you couldn't walk a city block without seeing someone with the white iPod earphones. Except it wasn't like that at all. Because in the summer of 1981, when you suddenly couldn't walk a city block without seeing someone in those flimsy Walkman headphones, no one had done that before. The soundtrack to your life, walking to the drugstore, getting on the bus, washing your car in the driveway, wasn't your own. It was chosen by the guy listening to his car stereo with the windows down, playing his boombox at the park, listening to the White Sox game at the lake. But the Walkman was yours. It was you. And it was brand new. That feeling we all know now, of shutting out the world, of having just the right song come on at just the right moment, of sitting in a crowded public place all by yourself, in a subway car, waiting in line at a Starbucks at an airport, walking by the river, walking nowhere on an elliptical machine at the gym, and having a song move you somewhere else or at some other time, like a Madeline, to that one time you realize what that one lyric actually means, to that time it came on the radio when you were driving with that guy you haven't even thought of in years, to the last time you heard it on the subway or in line at the airport, and it moved you.
Welcome back.
Maybe the sun will shine today. The clouds will blow away.
John Stewart and Pat Sansone are probably best known for their work with Wilco. John plays bass, and along with lead singer Jeff Tweedy, is one of only two of the founding members to remain with Wilco. Pat Sansone joined the band in 2004. He plays a variety of instruments. But for a decade, Pat and John have also had their own band, The Autumn Defense, which has released four CDs. This is the title track from their latest.
I fall on my knees to the ground. Around.
Once Around by the Autumn Defense. The band will be touring the country this fall, and founder John Stewart joins us from the Wilco Studios in Chicago, Illinois, your whole own studios. John, welcome.
Thank you.
Why two bands?
Early on in Wilco, I think it was pretty much set that Jeff was going to take a bulk of the songwriting, and was really incredibly prolific even back then. And I had a lot of songs laying around for a while, and I met Pat, who I had met briefly in the music scene in the Southeast in the late 80s, and we sort of bonded over this kind of the same sort of influences, a lot of just Beach Boys and Scott Walker, and it was kind of wild to meet a kindred spirit like that in New Orleans, so I felt it was sort of meant to be, and so we kind of started the band at that point. If I could make it through September,
you know, it's kind of sweet because if I hear what you're saying, you wanted to have your own band with your own songs, you know, and usually when that happens, that's when bands blow up. But it sounds as if this was a really nice kind of, you know, okay, we'll have Wilco, largely Jeff songs, and then you can go off and do that, but come on back.
Yeah, it's funny. It's always been really amicable, and it's sort of a really a full life of music, you know, is what it is. I never wanted to give up Wilco. It was always so exciting for me to be a part of, and continues to be.
Usually it's not your choice, you know?
That's
someone,
correct,
someone
right.
decides, I want to go write more songs. Oh, yeah, we'll go.
Right, that's very true.
Yeah. Well, and what would you say, how would you say the head you have to have for each band is different?
With Wilco, it's really more collaboration in a way. It's more personalities, it's more interaction, more people. It is a quest each time, whereas with Autumn Defense, it was more limited time, and there was something that was sort of welcoming with real deadlines and sort of just a little bit more effortless and organic or something. You know?
Effortless. That's how I would describe it. Let's listen. You and Pat both write songs and sing lead in Autumn Defense. Let's listen to your Step Easy.
You and I, we fly. You and I were part of a falling ember, and I should say goodbye, but I know it's always now or never. So step easy in the sun.
John Stirrott, is that purposeful? I mean, it feels as if this is a place where you can just fly. I think one of the lines that's coming to me, you know, those pitfalls are gone or something like that. It's easy.
It is with Patrick over the years. I've felt it's just felt very effortless. We have very similar tastes in movies and in art and photography, you know. There's definitely a brotherly sort of thing there, at least in the aesthetic.
Well, and your voices blend so well. Let's listen to Allow Me. This is the second track on the CD.
You don't know where to find the things you left behind. Allow me to love. Allow.
There's almost like a polka, or is there a little bit of a throwback here?
I would probably represent a lot more of a sort of country rock or a rootsy element than Pat, but I would say that our true loves are really, it's late 60s Anglo rock.
Well, and as we said, for people who just tuned in addition to the Autumn Defense, you're both in Wilco, you one of the founding members. And recently, Wilco had a multimedia festival at MassMoCA, that's the Museum of Contemporary Art, out in the Berkshires, out west here in Massachusetts. In fact, Pat Sansone had an exhibit of Polaroid photos, and we'll have some of them on our website. They're just beautiful. But in the interviews at the time, it sounded like you guys did this just because you could.
That's funny. You know, it kind of came out of a gig we played at Tanglewood 3 summers ago, I guess. It's a compound. There's several buildings on the site. And it really did occur to us. It's like, well, okay, we're having one big show at Tanglewood. We could kind of have a day and invite other bands to play these sort of outbuildings and sort of have our own one-day festival. And it would never have happened without the facility itself, which is just a world class destination for art in itself. So we figured we couldn't do too much damage if we curated a little music around that.
Oh, yeah, you could have. I mean, some of those sculptures, it could have been terrible. Oh. Well, we understand you're going back into the studio to start on a new Wilco album. Just one last question about Wilco. It's gone through a number of personnel changes. You're the only other person besides Jeff Tweedy who's been there from the beginning. And we were hearing on the Wilco DVD, Ashes of American Flags, that he could see the band continuing through personnel changes just as long as you're not one of the personnel to change.
He's being very kind. I don't know how true that is. I think the Wilco, sort of the name is sort of, you know, is going to be around for a while with or without me. But we have gone through quite a lot together. And, you know, I think I've been able to provide some stability, you know, for him over the years. And very much like Patrick, we had a lot of similar goals getting into it, and both feel incredibly lucky to still be making records that people listen to.
Well, you just finished a tour of Europe with Wilco, so let's listen to a little of that group. Here's Wilco, the song.
I've been attacked. Oh, this is a fact. You need to know.
Well, meanwhile, you also have Autumn Defense with Pat Sansone, and you've got this new CD and are going out on tour with Autumn Defense. Tour of Europe with Wilco, tour of Autumn Defense. Do you live anywhere?
Yeah, you know, I do. I have a family in Chicago, and actually, if you look at the Wilco calendar right now, there are no dates booked, and we're other than this little Autumn Defense jaunt, I think everyone's really happy to be sort of thinking about the studio and not going anywhere.
Right.
So, you know, my wife might not think I live anywhere, unfortunately, but we'll work on that.
John Starrett, co-founder of the Autumn Defense. Their new CD is Once Around. He's also the bassist for the band Wilco. He joined us from their studios in Chicago. John, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And I'll bring you there to the home.